So.
Oh, aber ganz lang.
Ja.
Good afternoon, this is Representative Howcrow. I am chairing a Labor and Commerce Special Subcommittee on Aviation Insurance. Today is the 16th of February at 1:34, and I'll call the meeting to order. Present is just myself, Chair Howcrow. Representative Hayes will be with us momentarily. Representative Cott is out of town. Today we're going to be discussing aviation insurance. This is the first of two hearings. We'll have a follow-up hearing next Wednesday during the same time period, 12:30 to 3. Those that testify today, if you have follow-up testimony next Wednesday, you certainly are welcome to put that forward. Today's hearing is really an effort just to gain a foundation as far as what are our options out there, and maybe kind of decide what kind of direction we're going to take. We have various testifiers in Anchorage, Homer, and I believe we have Fairbanks.
Matsu.
So we have several people on teleconference that are going to give testimony. Just a brief history of our working group here. My office started working on this subject earlier this fall. My staff, Kevin Hand, to some of you have spoken to Kevin on the phone, has done a tremendous amount of work on this. And our goal is simply to find a solution. We've received several faxes and emails and printed reports from various individuals. We have a tremendous amount of information which we're trying to decipher. So today, when you give your testimony, if you could, for the record, because we are recording this, state your name and company you're affiliated with, or if you're with an agency, please state your agency. And if you could do that clearly before you begin your testimony, the chair would appreciate it. In addition, please try and keep your testimony concise and brief. I think most of us understand the current condition of the market and how we arrived at this point in time. After your testimony, there might be questions from committee members, so please stay on the line and be available for questions. Present in attendance here in Juneau is Sarah McNair Grove from the Division of Insurance, and I'm going to ask Sarah to come to the table at the present time and give us kind of a brief overview. And before I do, I certainly would like to thank her and her department for the tremendous amount of work they've done so far in taking a look at this problem and coming up with suggestions. Can everybody on teleconference hear me clearly?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, Sarah.
Yes.
Okay. Director Laura, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Okay, Bob, Sarah is going to defer to you, so if you would proceed with any opening remarks or comments, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, and she does that very well, and I'll return the favor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The aviation industry provides an important transportation link for Alaska and the most critical link to rural Alaska. Insurance coverage is necessary to protect both the air carriers and the public who rely on them for transportation. Recently, the cost for this insurance coverage has jumped up to 50%, and in some cases, even higher. These dramatic rate hikes can be difficult for a business to absorb, especially while providing affordable services to the Alaskan public. The loss of commercial aviation operations would devastate people who live in rural communities, as well as the air carriers who provide the service. Mr. Chairman, the Division of Insurance has responded to your request to weigh in on this issue. We have provided you with an 8-page letter dated February 2nd, outlining some of the options that you may wish to consider. At the same time, we have tried to indicate clearly our view that there is no simple legislative solution that will eliminate the problem. Unfortunately, the market is sending an accurate signal about the riskiness of this market, and governmental intervention will not change this reality. Insurance affordability is a direct function of the frequency and severity of the losses that occur. Insurance availability problems can occur if the cost of the coverage to the air carrier becomes a significant portion of its operating expenses, or if the cost is rapidly increasing. Insurers may not be willing to offer coverage if they cannot cover their costs, or if legal disputes over coverage issues result in a broader interpretation of policy language than intended by the insurer who wrote the policy. The Division of Insurance has analyzed various options to address the availability and affordability. However, it is important to remember that whatever the organizational structure of the insurance mechanism, payment of losses and operating expenses are common to all of the options. When losses and operating expenses are high, insurance costs are high. When losses and operating expenses are reduced, insurance costs also go down. The small size of the Alaskan market, the difficult weather and geography and seasonal operations are some of the realities, both for air carriers operating in Alaska as well as the insurance companies. However, if the Alaska aviation community and insurance industry find better ways to address aviation safety, find ways to improve loss ratios and reduce costs, insurance coverage will become less costly and easier to find. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify and for specific technical questions. As you indicated, Ms. McNair-Grove is available in general. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Sarah, let me ask you, could you outline some of the precedents that have been set with regards to the state getting involved in a situation where insurance is either completely unavailable or expensive to obtain?
I'm not specifically aware of situations like this. We do have the assigned risk market for both the workers' compensation insurance and the assigned the auto insurance, because both of those coverages are required by law. And if insurers don't want to provide coverage in the voluntary market, there has to be a way to do them. So we have those mechanisms to provide coverage that is otherwise unavailable.
And if we did get to the point where the state was involved in some kind of a pooling or had some kind of involvement, your department, what role would your department play in oversight?
If it's organized as an insurance company, then they would be subject to all of the statutes that insurance companies are subject to in Title 21.
Thank you very much. First, we're going to go to we will go to Homer and take testimony from Gary Porter. Mr. Porter, are you online, sir?
The green light's on, so I'm online, I guess.
Okay. Go ahead and proceed with any testimony you have.
All right, thanks. My name's Gary Porter. I represent Bald Mountain Air Service. I was hoping I could hear some more testimony here so I'd be able to comment, but comment on what other people said. But, basically, I guess the first thing I wanted to know, I just had the question, the Division of Insurance, if there's any regulation similar to other states, is the aviation insurance business in Alaska regulated? I guess I asked that question through conversation with different government agencies. I understand that it's not. Could I get an answer now, or should I wait for an answer?
Certainly. Hold on just a second, Ms. Porter. I'm going to ask Sarah to rejoin us at the table, and maybe you just want to stay with us.
This is Sarah McNair-Grove. Aviation insurance in Alaska is regulated very much like it is in most other states, and that is it does not have the degree of regulation from rate filing and form filing as most of the other lines of insurance do.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure whether or not other states or regulated insurance companies, providers of insurance, have them take into consideration frequency of loss rates for individual businesses, training, length of experience, and so on. I guess what I'd say was that it's my experience when I go to my broker every year, I've asked him to portray my company, my business, to the insurance companies, because I feel that I go to extra expense to provide a safe trip for my clients. And I've been told basically that there isn't really a whole lot of consideration for the individual businesses, that Alaska is basically looked at as a whole. I talked with one insurance company in Los Angeles, and they relayed that to me also, that we were pretty much lumped together, and that Alaska as a whole had a frequency of loss rate that was basically pointed towards these extremely high rates. And so I always wondered if there was a way that I felt that it wasn't fair that we go to that much trouble and that it wasn't taken into consideration. But I've just been told basically that, well, it must be taken into consideration because they're willing to sell me insurance just at a very high price.
Mr. Porter, are you a seasonal flyer or do you fly year-round?
We're seasonal float plane operator.
Okay, and did you have at one point in time seasonal coverage, or have you always had coverage that mandates you pay based on 12 months?
We had seasonal coverage. Basically, the policy is wrote for year-round, and it used to be when we went with the previous insurance company of EMCO, they gave consideration for just the time that you were active, and then they just basically reimbursed you for the time that you didn't use the insurance, the time that you weren't flying. Now we're back to they call it a Northwest scale, where we most of the premium is earned, 85-90% of it is earned in the 4 months that we're the most active. And so it doesn't pay really to ask for a reimbursement. It's pretty much used up.
And what has the shift in coverage availability done to the cost of your premiums?
We haven't, we're one of the lucky ones, I guess, and haven't had claims. So we've never really had trouble finding coverage. There's always been at least two companies that we're willing to write, and then of course we take the cheapest one. Our insurance has basically doubled in the last 5 years, I guess, and with no consideration really for lack of loss.
So the cost of your coverage has doubled, and they haven't taken into consideration you've been accident free during that time period.
No, as a matter of fact, we asked our broker to send, we went as far as having them send a video of, our promotional video and a good list of all the extra safety equipment and training that we go through to the insurance company. But it didn't make any difference. We were told that they really didn't have they didn't take it into consideration.
Thank you very much. Do you have any other testimony to give, Mr. Porter?
No, not this time.
Okay, thank you very much. Next in Homer, we'll go to Ken Day. Mr. Day, are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here. I'm Ken Day, and I represent Emerald Air Service here in Homer. And mine is just kind of a brief statement on the insurance company's policy that seemed and the accident rate. from watching it over the years, I've noticed that most of the accidents that we have up here are people coming up from the lower 48, low-time pilots trying to build time to move on to the airlines, and they come up here and they start looking, you know, 50 years in the back, trying to make themselves a name, and flying into adverse weather, getting themselves in trouble and hurting people, and then the rest of us who have good flying records and do fly in safer weather and take extra cautions to be safer and not hurt anybody or anything, we're all penalized for it. And they don't realize that as they penalize us, that people are going out of business, and the FAA has told me that they're having certificates handed in so fast that they don't know what to do because people can't afford the insurance. And it's just, you know, we're all suffering for it. It's just like the Reeve going out of business, and leaving people stranded throughout the state on their routes. And this state is very, very dependent on aviation, not just for people who live here for transportation, but also for the tourist industry. And each air taxi that you put out of business, you're probably going to put three or four other people somewhere down the line in the parks business and tourist industry out of business, and therefore this whole insurance thing is hurting the whole economy, the whole statewide. And I just don't see that us that live here and we fly here and have for years and have good safety records and we're higher timed are penalized because of somebody coming up from the lower 48 and, you know, trying to make a name for themselves and hurting people. But we're basically all penalized for it, and I just don't see that that's right, and we need some kind of relief.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Mr. Day, is your service seasonal, or do you operate year-round?
We operate seasonal.
Seasonal, okay. And what type of business is yours, Mr. Day?
Well, we're in the bear viewing tourist industry. We fly people out to see the brown bears, and we do fly, it's the air taxi type also. We do fly people into remote camps and fly fishing game and other businesses, their supplies into them.
Okay. And what effect on your premiums has the shift in the availability of coverage done to you?
Well, it continues to climb, and right now we can't even get a statement out of our insurance company as to what our increase is going to be at this last go-round. We do get letters that the one who has been covering us, LAU out of Seattle, is no longer going to renew policies or write any new policies, and we don't know who we're going to be insured through this time.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anything further, Mr. Day?
No, not at this time.
Okay. And for those folks in Homer, I would ask you just if you could to hang on the line. Representative Scalzi is going to be in attendance momentarily, and his staff is here. So Representative Scalzi might have some questions for those folks in Homer. So if I could ask you just to hang tight. Next, we're going to go to Anchorage, Ann Graham.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record and give us any testimony you wish.
My name is Ann Graham. I'm the Regional Safety Program Manager with the FAA. I'm here with actually Jerry Patterson, who is a Special Assistant to the Division Manager. I wasn't aware that we were giving testimony today, sir. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Certainly. Thank you very much, and we appreciate you making yourself available for this. And there has been we've had some internal discussions working on this problem, and some folks have said that you know, possibly a greater presence by the FAA and safety checks, or everything from safety checks to investment in technology, certainly might reduce risk. Can you talk to the committee about what the FAA is doing as far as this problem is concerned, and any, you know, any strides you're taking to improve?
I'm going to let Mr. Patterson answer that question for you, sir.
We have quite a few efforts going on this year with the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. We're doing a study of aviation safety in Alaska. Actually, it's a three-year program in which we really want to identify what interventions we can have, how we can mitigate the risks that are out there. We also are working with the individual inspectors to, they're going to be going out this year and working with the commuter air carriers to sort of share some new techniques for how some operators, successful operators, are better controlling their flights. In the Bethel area, just started, just finished up a program we call Capstone, wherein the FAA has actually provided people with the navigation equipment, and it's been quite a success in that we've avoided installing a $20 million radar, but at the same time provided people with radar-like services out there. We're also working to take similar technology, not identical technology, but similar technology down to Southeast Alaska, wherein in both places then we would be able to provide the pilots right there in the cockpit with better weather information. We're doing a new style of inspection where we're actually going out to look at operators rather than strictly for compliance. We're going to look at operators to see whether they really have systems in place to that lead to a safe operation. We're working with the industry. We have an alliance for safety. We have an annual meeting, and we continue year-round working with the operators, sharing safety information with them and developing initiatives with them. And of course, you probably read we have a major program to prevent runway incursions. That program's nationwide. It's quite active here in Alaska, where we've had meetings around the state. We've got more and more meetings, more and more interventions on runway incursions. We're experimenting with different alternatives for providing runway lights to rural communities. As you know, providing runway lighting out to rural communities is quite expensive, especially when you have to build the generator also. So we're experimenting with some different alternatives. We're cooperating with the states and with the different air carriers. Obviously, the FAA spends millions of dollars on airports every year, and I think we'll obviously continue that. We're expanding our safety program that we have. We've had a safety program for several decades now, and we're expanding that to where the safety program managers and the different field officers go out and work actually with the air carriers. So, and we're always looking for new ideas, new things to do. So we're actually planning our next year's activity. So if somebody has an idea, they can always give us a ring. My phone number is 271-5110, and Ann Graham is at 271-5912.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Mr. Patterson, I have a couple of questions for you. Do you have, for instance, if an operator wants to voluntarily be inspected, do you have a program where they would call you and they would say, can you come over to my operations, take a look at what we're doing, and kind of give us an audit, and a friendly audit, and see how we can improve? Do you provide that service?
We haven't in the past. Each of the offices does have programs where they go out and visit with the operators. We don't have exactly the program you described, but we do see ourselves as somewhat of a catalyst. We should be sharing with the operators on our visits things that are successful for other operators. We don't have exactly the program you're discussing.
And Mr. Patterson, and I'll tell you, this my question comes from a conversation I had last week. Here's my concern, or a concern. If an operator is is uneasy about inviting your staff over to give kind of a voluntary audit because they think they might be penalized. You can see where that might discourage somebody from actually asking for help. But if the FAA had a program where an operator could call and say, can you come over and take a look at my operations, if you find any violations, not to write them up, but just to simply point them out, maybe give them a fix-it ticket or something like that. Is there anything being is there any possibility of doing something like that to really encourage some of these smaller operators to have you come and interact with them about possible changes to their safety programs?
Well, what we do have is the program wherein minor violations that we find, we settle with the operators by writing them a letter, making a record of it, asking them to correct it. We also have a program with individual pilots. If we find a minor violation, we write them a written warning and go on our way. We don't exactly have a program wherein we come out and look at an operator voluntarily, although we do have encourage operators to have their own safety officers in each company, and those safety officers would have us run a similar program where they would not only just be able to review their company and how they operate, but also be able to fix it on the spot. So if there's some operator out there that would like some help to develop a program like that, we can certainly be available to help them.
In my concern, and I'll just state, I'm not an aviation expert by any means, but yeah, I know with my own business, certainly if OSHA were to come to my company and say, take a walkthrough and say, well, you should have that there, rather than just show up unannounced and give inspections, which is not a problem. But if there was more of a friendlier interaction, I think that might encourage smaller operators to embrace a stronger effort to be safe.
Okay, let me make a note of that. One thing, Andrew, that does concern me is Ann and I were asked to join you on a conversation, and we're not really authorized to speak for the FAA and develop new programs right now, but we'd be glad to make notes for consideration.
Certainly, and I appreciate that, and don't construe anything you say as a firm commitment, but I do appreciate you being here to answer questions because, as I said earlier, we're just trying to gather as much information. I can't thank you enough for being here. Second question is, does the FAA have any interaction with insurance carriers as far as, not necessarily a specific operator, but the market in general? Do you have any communications at all with the insurance agencies?
No, we do not.
No, you do not. Okay. All right. And the chair will recognize he's been joined by Representative Scalzi. Mr. Patterson, thank you very much for your testimony and answering questions.
You're welcome.
Next, we'll go to Dave Glenn. Dave, are you online?
Hi, this is Dave Glenn with Grasshopper Aviation in Wasilla. We're a year-round operation.
And Dave, did you have any testimony you wanted to give today to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a couple of comments. First of all, I beg to differ with the commissioner. His testimony sounded to me like a letter from the insurance company. I have not seen valid statistics that really say that we're flying unsafely in this state. We have accidents, that's sure, but they have them everywhere. And this disinformation has been distributed for so many years now by the insurance companies that it makes us look like a bunch of loonies up here flying our airplanes, when in fact, Alaska has probably the best pilots in the world. The other gentleman has testified about low-time pilots coming in and having problems. That's very true. But, on the whole, we probably fly some of the worst weather with the safest pilots in the world. I would like to see some real hard numbers from these insurance companies. Over the last 10 years, I've gone through about four because they come up, knock you off for $40,000 or $50,000 a year, and then they leave. I kind of think that a lot of these high rates are a result of them being in these 20-story buildings and paying somebody six-digit salaries and not from the claims in the state. It's all just kind of ridiculous. I have one claim, I've got a $300,000 home insurance policy on. It's got a $30,000 deductible. It's costing me $41,000 to insure the airplane. So when I get through paying for a $300,000 policy, I have $220,000 worth of insurance. So it's nuts. And we've been in this fix for a couple of years, and about two more, why, I'll be gone like a lot of the other guys, because the insurance companies make more money than I do. And something's wrong with that. I think somebody, you know, needs to get to the heads of these insurance companies, get them by the throat, and say, listen, fella, enough is enough.
They have to do business in Alaska. They have a choice.
I guess that's about it. And also, that, you know, they regulate our insurance where 4 months of the year you pay about 80-85% of your insurance. So there's no opportunity to take anything offline. And just to show you how they'll put it to you, I just purchased an airplane, and it was purchased 45 days before my policy ran out. And to add it on, I had to pay some $1,400 for 45 days to have it parked on the ground. This is not in motion. And they told me, well, that's because it was such a short term, we couldn't give you the regular 5% of your policy rate. So, I mean, every time you turn around, the insurance companies just bail you, and there's absolutely no choice. I guess that's all I've got to say, is I'm really bitter about it, and I'm bitter about the disinformation about our safety records, and people just keep pounding away at them, and I just don't believe it. And I guess that's all I've got to say today.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. Mr. Glenn, how long have you been in business, sir?
10 years with this operation.
10 years, okay. And the reason I ask is, you know, some say that the aviation insurance market is no different than other insurance markets where it's cyclical. You have a softening, then a hardening. During our research, we have found a number of people who speculated that, you know, maybe the rates in this state have been unrealistically low, and what you're seeing now is those companies finally getting the rates up, pulling out, or getting the rates up to a place where they can afford. In your 10 years of business, have you seen any of this cyclical nature that some have described?
Oh, it's cyclical. It just goes up every year. And I've been following this. People in Colorado pay maybe 3% hull insurance for the protection of the aircraft. This year I'm paying 12 in Alaska. So, you know, what's going on here? You know, an airplane here costs as much as an airplane in Colorado. And they talk about the losses. You know, the University of Oklahoma just suffered that tragedy down there. Millions of dollars. I don't see that going on here. So, you know, if they're selling nationwide, why isn't it regulated nationwide? And, you know, everything goes into the average because airplanes are transient. They don't just stay in one spot. You know, a lot of them leave the state, go to other states.
Question from Representative Scalzi.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, have you looked into self-insurance pools at all?
Well, how are you going to do that? I'm broke paying the insurance company. How can I self-insure?
Okay, I apologize for coming in late. I may have missed something earlier on, but I'll just relate. In the marine industry, back in the late 80s, there was a people who owned wooden vessels went through the same, very similar circumstance where insurance companies did not want to cover wooden vessels. They just made a blanket statement that too high a risk. As a result, there was pools formed down in the Seattle area where everybody became self-insured. They went out and got their own riders, and what they did was they disallowed anyone that they didn't feel was safe. They're very stringent. They could blackball anybody they wanted. And it sounds like it may be an avenue. I don't know how many pilots up here are in the business it would take to make a it financially solvent, but certainly you could exclude these the new people that were coming up that you're concerned about. And I noticed a testimony from one of my constituents earlier said that there is no consideration given to this good safety records, and I think that that's what happened in the wooden boats. They excluded anybody that they didn't feel was safe. That's the concept. I've looked into different insurance companies here in the state asking if there was anything that would preclude this from happening in the state of Alaska and whether there was some state regulations needed. And I was told no, that these pools are certainly allowed to be formed if, you know, enough people got together and could purchase the coverage. So my question is essentially whether or not you had looked into it. It sounds like you have not looked into that.
Well, to the contrary, there was a meeting in Anchorage about a month and a half ago considering a pool. And some of the folks in the insurance industry that I talked to subsequent to that have said they just don't see it happening. You know, the unfortunate part is small operators like myself and the other gentleman here testifying today, we don't have time to go out here and play insurance agent and attorney and spend days and hours in meetings trying to figure out this kind of thing. You know, we're regulated to the hilt, and then we have to go out here and make a living, and it's tough. And we're just a victim of the insurance industry right now.
Okay, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Commissioner Laura, are you still online, sir?
Chairman, I'm still online. Thank you for the promotion.
Oh, director, sorry. Bob, you're a commissioner as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask you, interesting point brought up in earlier discussions about what kind of information does your division get when there is an accident? And not only that, but what kind of information regarding losses do you receive from insurance carriers on a yearly basis?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't believe that we track accident losses per se. We probably use as informal and anecdotal method as almost anybody else, which is to simply read the press, read the papers. I do know that a single accident that runs policy limits, that it goes to the limit of what the coverage is, and if you just take that and compute how much time it takes in earned premium to cover one of those incidents, it's devastating. And that's one of our problems, is the relative smallness of the market compared to the number of risks. But in terms of formal statistics, we tend to look to formal sources such as mentioned by the FAA. The occupational safety and health people, epidemiology has looked at this. There are formal statistics out there which we could certainly provide to you, but they're not ones that we collect directly. Sarah, please feel free to correct me if that's inaccurate.
You are correct. We do get some minimal statistics in the annual statement, but it's aggregate numbers. What is the whole insurance company writing in terms of losses and premium? And it's not split between liability and hull, nor is it split between the private airplanes and commercial airplanes.
Now, Bob, we passed legislation, I believe it was last year, the year before, that came through Labor and Commerce that mandated insurance companies provide your division with more specific information in a greater deal of it. Do you remember that bill?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the tort reform efforts generally?
I think it was Representative Roekberg's bill about a year or two ago. He was concerned that we weren't getting enough data from insurance companies regarding health coverage.
That's correct. Representative Roekberg sponsored a bill that gave us authority to collect and required us to collect information on the number of Alaskans insured by health insurers, and we did gather information like that.
Okay. How about applying that to those that write aviation insurance? I mean, certainly you know, as you said, you can pick up the paper and you can read when there's a high-profile accident. But as Dave Glenn mentioned, I mean, you certainly don't pick up the paper every day and read how, you know, dozens and dozens of these operators take off and land safely. So my question to you is, could we mandate that insurers provide you with more detailed numbers?
Mr. Chairman, that would be a very promising approach, I believe. For example, as you know, we have not recommended mandating that the division have rate-making authority over aviation risk. However, if we had something that we call file and use, where when an aviation insurance company puts in effect a rate, they have to file that rate with us, we'd be able to track these rate patterns far more accurately. We'd have a better quality database for doing that. In addition, if it's not already collected elsewhere, collecting risk information or actual accident damage figures on an unaggregated basis, as Sarah suggested, broken out by liability and hull separately for Alaska specifically, might be useful information. We simply don't want to create a burden, and I don't want to be an apologist for industry, but making it more difficult to operate in Alaska as an insurance company is not part of the solution to this problem.
Certainly, and I understand that, but I think certainly Mr. Glenn brings up a very good point about how, you know, there's no real definitive information out there that shows exactly why they're raising premiums and why the market is such a risk. I agree with you. I think mandating, putting additional mandates on any insurance carriers tends to make them, back away from the market. But in this case, I certainly feel that, we wouldn't be asking too much just for them to simply tell us how much they've taken in premiums, what their losses were, break them out as far as hull or the other coverages. I certainly can't see where that would, put an undue burden on anybody.
Chair, I think that'd be a good idea. In addition, it might be appropriate to offer them a seat at the table, say next Wednesday.
Certainly.
And invite them to be heard on this question of just what is their basis. I know they won't talk trade secrets, but they might give a general indication of how they do look at risk.
In one of the overall thoughts that corresponds with that is certainly when there is an accident, in all I've read, and I'm sure everybody online already knows, to some degree, most of these accidents are preventable, whether it's pilot error, flying in whether they shouldn't have flown in, whatever the case may be. But if we could create a pool of information where insurance carriers would share that information with other coverage, other operators, so we can learn from some of the mistakes that have been made, I certainly think that more information in this case is a good thing.
I agree.
Okay. All right, thank you. Next we'll go to Patrick O'Hare in Mat-Su. Patrick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. My name is Patrick O'Hare, and I own O'Hare Aviation. My primary business is flight instruction, aircraft rental. In the past, I've operated in another state. I was the largest Cessna pilot center in the world, so I have a good background in flight training. No accidents, no losses other than a dinger here and there over 25 years, no deaths, no injuries. I basically this year have stopped my operation for the year 2001, just one airplane and me, no pilots, no flight instructors, no office staff, and it's just a one-man operation. My experience with the Alaska insurance, coming from the lower 48, and I've been here 10 years, so I'm not a new guy up here. For one example, I had a Beech 18 that was flying 135 in the lower 48, and the same insurance, this was 10 years ago, was 60 times, it cost me 60 times per dollar coverage than I was paying in the lower 48. So I stopped doing that operation, and I still have the airplane, but it's my private airplane. Last winter, I went down and helped a friend of mine up who was starting up an air ambulance and flying twin-engine Cessnas with a doctor, a nurse, aggravated injury, all these coverages. And his coverage for his 421 was $4,000 a year. My coverage for Cessna 150, which is a two-place trainer, one instructor, one student, was $6,000 a year. And I'm only flying seasonal, I'm not flying night, not flying bad weather. I think the two basic problems we really have here is when they rate companies, they rate the whole lower 48 as one group. If they rated them individually as states, a crash in Pennsylvania of a commuter airline would basically make their insurance rates go up if they use the same formula that they do here. But if there's one standard rate for the lower 48, they rate us as a group, I mean, as an individual group. And so by doing this, then they can basically charge us whatever we want and whatever they want. And I understand they also do this in Hawaii because of the geographical separation. So my feeling with this, my operation is no different than down there. I fly several months less a year just because of weather. Even if I wanted to fly, I can't be flying the amount that I did in the lower 48. But yet, my premiums are double, triple, and I was with the Vemco last year. They stopped writing. I had the ability to park the airplanes on a straight line basis. My only option now this year is pay for insurance year-round. So not only are they charging us three times as much on a rate premium, we fly less. So that's the problem. The solution that I have, I think that they should rate Alaska nationwide. And we should be looked at as the aviation industry in the United States of America. We are part of the United States of America. Now, this will take a federal action. If you're going to write, all airplanes are federally regulated. And if you, I'm sure that airliners, the major airlines, the flag airlines, say that even if they fly just within the United States, they're not rated individually by state, they're rated nationwide. So I think a nationwide rate would be a solution. And I don't want to take too much time, but one other comment that we have here, when I look at statistics, there's a lot of people up here that don't have insurance, and yet when they crash, or there's damage or whatever, it doesn't go against the insurance company's bottom line. However, they gleefully use those statistics to say, well, look, it's more accident prone. And the reason for the, it's, in the lower 48, everybody had airplane insurance. But up here, it's a lot of people, I just can't afford it. Why am I going to spend $5,000 to use my airplane to go hunting? I'll take the risk. I'm going to take it out of my house and go to my cabin, and if I crash, that's it. So they're losing those dollars because of in there, which would help the pool. But there's so many things here, and I believe that what we're getting from the insurance company is really truly disinformation. If you look at, you could rate, they've had things where they, I know I saw something a while back in California that they were rating people in different cities, different rates, and charging them for automobile insurance. If you do that, and if you pick and choose a market, then you can do it. So they're doing the exact same thing to Alaska, but yet our accidents, all the people that I know and the people that are concerned about this, we're saying we're not going to, you know, primarily, we're in the airplane most of the time, so we don't want an accident, because the old joke is, but it's the truth, we're the first one to the scene of the accident because we're in the front seat. But basically, those are my comments. And I think in summary, we are charged 3, 6, 8, 10 times. I know other operators are going out of the business. I have personally gone out of the business, except for a one-man operation, which is considerably smaller and everything. Problem on the end of this is flight training that is, the flight schools are going to go out of business, so where are the pilots going to get trained? They're not. And the other thing that is not commented on here, I know the aviation mechanics are getting really hammered by the same thing. So, and they're just in a shop working on an airplane, but yet their rates are going up 3 and 4 or 5 times. And I think the reasons are going up. get the same coverage that you give in another state for the same operation. And there's no insurance committee or I'm looking for a term here, but no authority for the state to protect the citizens against this thing. We need insurance to operate. It's mandated for the air taxi operators. It's just common sense. I'm not going to risk everything I own by not having insurance. But yet, there's no mechanism where if all of a sudden a gallon of milk was $50 a gallon, there would certainly be some legislative action on it. But there's nothing on airplane insurance. So, I get a little excited out here, but I'm doing this in all respect, and I'd like to see a solution to the problem. But again, I think the problem is they rate us individually, and they look at us in a microscope, and if they rate us nationwide, maybe through federal regulation, then that would probably be one of the solutions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. O'Hare. Mr. O'Hare, when Avemco canceled your policy or didn't renew, did they give you any kind of an explanation?
Well, I got a letter from them saying, as you know, we announced it several months ago, which they didn't, but we're not going to renew commercial operators in Alaska. They just wanted to get rid of the risk. They wanted to work on just to go to private coverage. They didn't want to do any commercial. That's it. That's an internal decision that they can make, and I don't have any problem with that. That's the business decision they make. And the insurance companies can't be forced to do business in the state of Alaska. They can all pull out. However, if they want to pull out of the whole United States and be nationally regulated, then they'll have to accommodate the market. I'm not a legal expert. I'm not an insurance attorney. I don't know the ins and outs of it. However, I do see the end result when I get a quote for an airplane that is just essentially, I close my business, I've got a fleet airplane sitting out there that I'm going to be selling off this year. I fly thousands of hours a year training pilots, renting airplanes to pilots. People that I train, most of them wind up buying their own airplanes. And so this segment of the industry is going to have a snowball effect. We're going to lose them. And the guys that are pilots aren't going to be able to get more training. I have no people that are going to the lower 48 to get their training in the wintertime because, hey, I can do it down there and the rate's cheaper and all that. And I can't compete with that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. O'Hare. Next, we'll go to Jack Barber.
Hi, I'm Jack Barber. I own Alaska Air Taxi, born and raised here in Anchorage. I've listened to everybody's comments. In the last probably a year, I've been in the process of drafting up letters to send all the air taxi operators. There's currently about 435 operators in the state of Alaska, made up of about 90% being 135 and the other is probably 121. The proposal that I've been working on is that we form a co-op, the same as how John Deere got started, which then mandate a seat cap. We get the state of Alaska to fund a pool of money. The seat cap is to protect the pool of money. It'd be an interest-free loan. As we continue to pay our premiums, the state would drag their money back out of there. We would become, in a sense, self-insured on this program. We would own it. We'd also have to mandate a flight clinic that all of us that are in the co-op would have to send our people to this clinic. So a lot of the accidents that you see around the country here, we all know it could be eliminated. We probably produce some of the finest pilots in the world out of Alaska here. And there's guys that started in the bush and, you know, bail draggers that are running 747s global, right? And those people are available, you know, to man some of these flight clinics. Thing to remember is that, you know, the air taxi operator, he's the primary link for probably 80% of the state of Alaska. There's no infrastructure. All the medevac, the fuel, the mail, the groceries, general transportation, Department of Defense, counts on the air taxi operators. And the state, in many cases, has subsidized commercial fishing, you know, forestry, timber companies, and yet they cultivate the tourist industry, and we're a big part in that. And if they don't step up to the plate, you know, all of this is going to go away. And I don't, you know, I mean, I think competition ought to be fair. And when I have to, when you offer a $20 million policy, all you're doing is chumming the water for every legal firm out there in aviation claims to go after it. And, you know, that's why the insurance companies are where they're at. They're in business too. And, you know, they have a $20 million payout and they collect 18 in premiums. So, you know, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that's not going to last. And so they put us all in the same pool. Everybody pays for everybody else's accidents. And, you know, it has to stop. Pilot training, flight schools, you know, these airplanes, we know we fly in bad weather. Probably half of the people, you know, that are flying around, even in 135, as far as instrument proficiency, I doubt very much that half of them can pass an IFR check right and be comfortable IFR. And, you know, this is things that have to change. Accident analysis, you know, I think that's an unfair, Dave. Grasshopper Aviation made the comment. You know, we're very unique up here to anywhere else in the lower 48. You know, we use airplanes up here. They're recreational flyers, and so it makes us look bad on paper. And, you know, if you take the flight miles and conditions we have to fly in on a daily basis, you know, it's a little unfair analysis, I think. That's about, I guess, my comment. I realize there would be some political and legal hurdles to come over, but until we form together, we have no power. And I always statement that we're not, you know, we need to stick together if we're going to have any way to make this happen. And all you'd have to do is think about it. If we decided all this wasn't going to fly come Monday morning, we'd sure have somebody's attention here in a couple, 3 days. That's the end of my comment.
Thanks, Jack. Jack, certainly, you know, in the reason for the committee looking at this is we want to find a solution just like you do. And I think, you know, there's a number of people in this building that recognize the importance of the service that you provide. In some rural communities, air is the only way in or out. And I think those folks are very concerned about what's happening. Let me ask you, Jack, did you attend the meeting in December, the one-day meeting they had regarding the, you know, the idea of forming the pool?
I did not attend that because I wasn't interested in an outside entity. I want our own insurance pool that's run and organized by all of us that are in the Air Taxi 135 operation. General aviation, not being disrespectful to general aviation, but I don't, I want to completely, I guess, isolate ourselves in a sense that the issue is we need to own our own insurance. We need to be self-insured. And I've talked to one of the business, or Alaska Business Insurance, for one, they're willing to manage the program for us. They think it's a workable solution to this, but the bottom line is that we used to have seat caps. There was vending machines in the terminals over here. If I think it was a $25,000 seat policy, if you felt you needed more insurance than that, then you put money in the vending machine and bought additional insurance. And if you don't put a seat cap on it, I don't know how you're going to protect any pool of money. I mean, there's a number of accidents around that. This last one up at Nuiqsiq was, I think USAIG was the carrier. They settled out of court on third party. and they pulled completely out of the market. And, you know, it leaves big holes in it, so everybody that's sitting around here wondering where to go to pretty soon, they don't even want to insure it. And I don't know what the state's, you know, where their input is going to be on this, but that's the way I see it.
And the reason why I asked if you attended that December meeting is we've had some discussions with folks that were in attendance in that meeting, and you brought up safety programs. And one of the concerns from some of the attendees was in the discussions about creating this pool, there was talk about, you know, some of these guys are going to have to start maintaining in operating the rigid safety programs. And, you know, there was kind of a backlash about that. People were saying, hey, I don't want anybody telling me how to run my business. And I certainly think that obviously safety and training have a great deal to do with avoiding some of these accidents. What is your feeling regarding, you know, a pool or anybody maintain or mandating safety programs that you would have to abide by?
I've called number of operators from on the Kenai Peninsula to Arctic Circle in Fairbanks, and mandating a training program or a flight clinic. If you look at the airlines, I mean, you can go get in their simulator at FedEx, and you never even, I mean, you can get out of the simulator and you go right into the airplane. And we have the tools and technology, and I mean, there's no substitute for training. And all of these accidents we're having, I can look up at Haglin and some of them that they didn't have to happen. And we can, I know through a flight clinic that we can eliminate them. Not all of them, but a big percentage of them. And so anybody that would be against, you know, flight training, I'd be more, you know, I'm a year-round operator. I'd be more than willing to send my people to a flight clinic, and then we shouldn't have to send them down to take flight or anywhere else in the lower 48 to get proper training, because we're a little unique up here. I think it needs to be tailored around exactly the kind of flying we do.
Are you familiar with the programs at the university?
Somewhat.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe, you know, maybe the university is a consideration, but you know, we, right now, what I'm looking at is full motion simulators with 180 degree wraparound visual. So if a guy's never been in Bethel before, I can put him in a simulator and he can be as familiar with Bethel as a guy that's been there for an extended period of time. And that's available to us, and we're not using for one accident. Like a $5 million claim on it, I can build the best flight clinic in the world for $5 million bucks. You know, and it's just crazy that the insurance companies, they pay out this kind of money and we don't build any kind of training facility to eliminate it.
Thank you, Representative Scalzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you've kind of covered some of the things I was going to ask, but Jack, thank you very much. That's an interesting concept. I think that you said you thought the state should kind of forward fund this pool money, if I understood you right. And I was encouraged by the comments you made regarding the safety program. Would you also be in favor of a minimum requirement or of some of the pilots? In other words, if they didn't meet certain standards or historical records, they would not be permitted into this pool, so to speak, or would this be open to everybody in your idea?
People would have to qualify in a sense, but as you know, it's harder and harder to come by pilots. And what I try to do is the same as the airlines, you know, you have your older veterans, and then you have to bring somebody new, and you got to move these people up the ladder. But you know, if we don't train people, pretty soon there isn't going to be anybody here to fly airplanes. You know, we're all going to go away, and all this early pioneer in aviation, you know, there's guys that are in their 80s now that, you know, they're slowly disappearing along with me. And so what's important is to take a company, and so you have a load time so you can move him up the ladder, and you expose him to different things and maybe tougher flying as his experience grows. And initially, I think most of us are on about a 2,000 hour minimum to qualify with any of the carriers for insurance. You know, that may be the starting point, I don't know. But, you know, we need to move people up the ladder, but training is ultimately the solution to this. None of us are immune to having accidents, but I've watched it all my life, and, you know, some of them are good pilots that end up either killing themselves or somebody else. And in most cases, you know, I think if we had training available to us at a high level, that we'd eliminate half of the accidents.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And the chair will also note the presence of Senator Osterman. Senator, welcome. Jack, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Anchorage, Mike O'Neill.
I'm Mike O'Neill. I own Security Aviation. We're a company that's been in business for 16 years. We have 5 aircraft. They're all twin-engine. We fly for a variety of companies, government agencies, individuals. In the 16 years we've been in business, we had one incident, which was determined by the FAA and the NTSB not to be pilot error. It was a claim that concerning an airplane and a fault with the FAA, and the insurance carrier subrogated against the government and collected money. And so basically we've never had a claim that's cost the insurance company any money. We have probably the highest limits that are available to an operator of our size. And at this point, it equates to $1 million a seat. It's an amount that I feel is insufficient for my own mutual protection. These airplanes are basically my retirement, and I don't care to be the victim of some plaintiff or a widow on something. And when we first started out, we were afforded $30 million overall with no problem at all. And our insurance a year ago, the premium was $226,000. And that, in my opinion, was probably 5 or 6 times as much as I would pay if I was in Seattle or Key West or even in the Whitehorse, Yukon territory. But the fact that we're in Alaska, we have only 1 or 2 carriers that will write, and it's a matter of supply and demand, and take it or leave it. This year, our premium increased to $510,000, and an increase of basically $285,000 over last year, or 125% increase in premium. And upon notification of that, I gave very serious thought about shutting it down, because this equates to the first $2,000 every day goes to the insurance company. And if the weather is bad today, we don't fly anywhere, then the first $4,000 tomorrow goes to the insurance companies. I think that the problem we have here is that there is probably 15% of the operators equate to 80% of the claims. And I just don't understand why the insurance companies continue to insure these people. They probably don't have the amount of coverage I have, and for what coverage they have, they probably pay more per dollar than most. In respect to the FAA, I think that there could be a little bit more concentrated effort towards this 15%, and either the FAA put them out of business or the insurance companies not write them. then they would probably make life a lot easier for everybody and also the FAA and from the enforcement standpoint. I concur with Jack Barber. We need to have an insurance pool, and as a comparison of what I would, or a introduction to this thing, I'd like to say that everybody that's in the business, or you would have to be selective if someone had a part of the 15%, would not be allowed into the pool. Everybody determine what your rates would be for the same amount of insurance if you lived in Seattle or Key West or wherever. Double that amount, put it into the pool, and in the state of Alaska, come in with 100, 200 million on top of that. Hire some professional national company to manage this who would then go out and get reinsurance over the top of that pool amount. And then as at the end of each year, if you didn't have any claims, you'd have maybe a 15% credit carried over towards the next year. If you had one claim, maybe you'd pay a certain percentage higher. And gradually work to this thing that the pool would build up where we would need less support from the state. And I also concur that it should be a loan type thing with no interest. And this was something that was done some years ago by the doctors. They were unable to get coverage. They started their own pool. It was very successful. I understand the lawyers, surprisingly, they couldn't get insurance. And another gentleman there mentioned the boating industry, commercial fishing. The difference there is that that was only on the value of the hulls, and they did not need any liability insurance for passengers like we might have. I think that another thing that could be done is to see some hard numbers. The insurance commissioner there, it would seem like that it should be mandatory that you obtain from the insurance carriers that are writing up here how much they collect in premiums and how much they actually pay out in claims, not how much they hold back in reserves for anticipated payouts. I think that in my own experience here, I subscribe to numerous publications involving safety and accident investigation, and there's accidents happening all over the country, and there's fatalities happening all over the country. And I also concur with the other gentleman that said that why are we in the Alaska pool? You know, I don't want to be in the Alaska pool. I want to be in the Indiana pool, or the pool that covers Ohio and California and 48 states, and get the type of rates that they're getting down there. Going back to what we are paying as a comparison, if I was in the lower 48, I could probably get $50 million coverage. And my premium as of 60 days ago would have been the neighborhood of $95,000 to $100,000. And I have yet to work out the equation as to how much more I'm paying in premium. It's not just a matter of paying five times as much in premium, but I'm getting roughly about 1/50th of the coverage that could be afforded to me. So I think it's something that, that the state can get involved in. The state is not going to be able to force insurance companies to do anything, and probably before long, seeing the way that the insurance companies are operating, they'll get unhappy with people like me and everybody else here that's testifying, and we won't have insurance available to us. They'll walk out of here and say goodbye. So I think it's time for the state to do something, because if not, we're going to end up with more accidents. Guys are going to say, hey, the weather's crap today. I got to go out and fly because I got to make an insurance payment tomorrow. If I don't fly today, I'm in trouble, and people are probably going to go out and not, you know, hopefully they don't have accidents, but they're going to do flying in conditions that they shouldn't do. So I guess that's my comments.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Mike, let me ask you, in your written testimony you provided to the committee, you mentioned, there's a paragraph where you mentioned what you just stated about you know, operators being forced to fly because they have to make their payments, including their insurance payment, so they push the weather. But you used a term in here I'm not familiar with, scud running?
Well, that's not quite IFR, but really not quite VFR. They're flying right at the very limit, at the base of the clouds, and staying above the ground and away from the trees, I guess.
Okay. Great. Let me ask you a question, Mike. And you had mentioned, you know, the state being involved in backing or reinsuring some kind of a pool. And one of the interesting comments you made was 15% of the operators equate to 80% of the claims. Now, with a pool, and obviously with kind of essentially a local control of a pool where you would have, you know, a company running it, but you'd have, I'm assuming, a board or some kind of management where those carriers that are involved in the pool, are invested in the pool, would have some kind of say on accepting, you know, on who to accept, who not to accept. With local control like that over a over the pool, what do you think your chances of reducing risks are, simply because you have people involved making decisions that know what's going on in the industry? For instance, I'm making myself clear. For instance, you might be able to say to the board, well, look, I know Joe's air service is not really a safe operation. I know he's doing some things on a shoestring over there. I think we either need to A, drop him, B, not accept him into the pool, or C, you know, have a little chat with him. Do you see any merit behind that theory?
Not really. I think that it shouldn't be up to other operators to go to these guys that are the bad guys. It should be a self-policing thing on the part of the operator. And my observations of this is that you know, simulator training, that's nice, and we're talking about these flight clinics or whatever they are, but the business is just as safe as the attitude of management. It bleeds down, and if you got a bandit running a place, you're going to end up having accidents, and you're going to have bandit employees working there. So I don't think that individuals going to them will do it, but if they see the economic threat of, hey, if I don't clean my act up and I'm not in the pool, I may not get insurance from anybody at all, and I'm out.
And I understand that. I guess my point, and I'm looking too far ahead in an attempt to sell any idea that might come out of this committee whereby the state would have to put up some money. Certainly there's going to be members in this building that are going to be very concerned about the risk of state funds, putting state funds at risk, and are going to want to have some kind of control measure to make sure that these folks in the pool that do not self-police are either, you know, dropped from the pool or probably better if they weren't allowed to come in. So I guess my thought is that nobody knows the industry like competitors know the industry. I mean, you know what your competitors are doing. Your competitor knows what you're doing. You have a general idea what your competitor's operation is like. And I'm assuming the rest of the people in your industry know what your operation's like. And so they say, well, that Mike O'Neill, he runs a real good operation over there. He's safe. He knows what he's doing. Not a problem. But, you know, Joe Smith, here's a guy who's running on a shoestring. We might have a problem with him. So I'm just simply looking for ways to reduce the state's exposure if, in fact, we get into a situation where there's state funds backing a pool up.
Well, I think there's probably more exposure to the guy that isn't let in, who runs to his local representative or senator and says, hey, I need some muscle. You know, this is state funds. I want to be in there. I deserve to be in there because it's my money, supposedly. I think that we're doing probably what the insurance company should be doing, that we're being selective on who gets insurance. And the biggest stumbling block is how you marry 200 million from the state of Alaska with a group that's not going to let everybody that's a citizen of Alaska get in the club.
Sure. Okay. Thanks, Mike. Next, we'll go to R.D. Russo. Mr. Russo, are you there, sir? Okay, next we'll move on to Johnny Ellison. Mr. Ellison, are you there, sir?
Mr. Chairman, could I interrupt just for a moment? I'm Jack.
Yes, sir.
With Mike, one of the comments I was going to make, these high seat limits, these $20 million policies, we probably shared customers. One of the comments is that even though they require a $10, $20 million policy, they admitted that they could waiver everything over $2.75 million. My concern is that, you know, we all should be on a level playing field, in a sense, and I was just curious what your feeling might be on that.
Well, I certainly, Jack, I think that is something we have initially discussed internally here as far as coverage limits, tort reform as it relates to aircraft liability. It was my understanding, and I'm not quite sure if I had the facts of the case right, but I think the accident that was mentioned a while back by a previous somebody who previously testified, the crash happened, there were limits in place, but somehow there was a third party that pierced those limits and put the insurer at a greater risk. And I'm not quite sure I understood the dynamics of that right, but it sounds to me like there is some concern with liability as far as per seat limits and overall tort reform.
Okay, thank you.
So that is something we will discuss. I can tell you tort reform is a very difficult subject to have in this building, but certainly if we think it will help solve the situation, we will not, you know, certainly won't be afraid of bringing up the topic. Is there anybody else online that would wish to give testimony at this time that I've either missed or has already spoken and just wants another bite at the apple?
Yeah, this is Gary Porter in Homer. I'd like to make an additional comment.
Go right ahead, Gary.
Now that I've heard everybody else, I got a few more ideas. Thanks. Getting back, we had prior testimony from, I believe it was a fellow from the FAA. I think Ted Stevens put in some kind of a bill here last year, the year before, for interagency information gathering. They're creating a database. I think it's called Air Claims. And probably Mr. Patterson with the FAA could probably give you more information on it. But they were actually dissecting the aviation insurance claim history in Alaska, dissecting it down pretty definitively. as to, you know, age of the pilots, time of day, just about everything that you could need. And I think the reasoning for this, that was behind this, was that aviation insurance, the cost of aviation insurance in Alaska directly affects a safety. In other words, there's a cause and effect there. The more money you spend on insurance, the less money you're going to spend on proficient pilots, maintenance, safety, safety equipment, on and on. So I'm sure that the FAA and NTSB has that concern. The other thing that I'd just like to touch on is I'm all for this pooling of insurance. As long as I'm pooled up with somebody of like kind, from what I understand, there's a third, over a six-year period, there's a third of the operators that cause 100% of the claims or the accidents in Alaska. So that means two-thirds of the operators in Alaska have no claims over a six-year period. You know, these statistics here, again, will probably come out of this study that's being done now. I think it's a three-year study. From what I understand, you could clarify it pretty easy, I would imagine, but of the two-thirds that don't have claims, the overwhelming majority of them are, I guess, what you call mom and pop or small operators, two or three airplanes, maybe one of them. Now that might kind of point to you know, who knows who we partner up with in these pools. I don't think a Alaska-wide pool. I don't want to be in the pool with everybody. That kind of translates into getting back to that Alaska average of loss. You know, I don't enjoy the Alaska average of loss. I'm a little better off than that. I wouldn't want to be lumped in. It is, I guess, time maybe for the ones that are causing the accidents to either pay a substantial increase in premiums or maybe fade out. I guess the last thing I'd like to say is, you know, you talk an awful lot of money here that's coming out of these local economies. You know, when we're paying $50,000-$60,000, just a couple of airplanes, one, two airplane operation, maybe three, it's coming right out of this economy of this little town here. You know, and you add them all up, boy, it's $30-40 million coming out of rural Alaska, basically. Boy, it's a hit. It's a hit on the communities. I think the total loss for 1999 was $25 million, if my paperwork's right here. There was $30 million taken in premiums. Some companies lost money, some made money. I'm not sure if I followed the other comments that the state had to put up a couple hundred million. It seems like the total insurance premiums paid were $30 million for 99. The total loss incurred was $25 million. So some percentage over the amount of loss in the event of catastrophic losses beyond that would be appropriate. But I don't. How much money are we talking about here that the state would have to put up?
Well, thanks. Oh, sorry. Thanks, Gary. And to answer your question with regards to state participation, I really couldn't answer that. I'm sure any number we agree on, certainly we'll all realize, has to go through the appropriate process in this building. And with a $530 million projected budget deficit for next year, we're going to have to make a heck of a case for it. Is there anybody else online that would like to add comments before we cut off?
Yes, I would. This is Ken Day in Homer. And it's just a brief statement. You know, you said that we had to really prove our point to get any funding by the state to help the aviation industry with this insurance pool. But it seems to me like every time the fishing industry has a bad day or a bad year or a bad fishing season, the state jumps on it and gives them money and makes all these concessions for them because they're fishermen. And, you know, the aviation industry is just an important industry in the state of Alaska, and it serves a lot more people than just the fishing industry, because a lot of the fishermen come up from down in the lower 48 or other places. But most of us that own and operate airplanes here, we live here, and we deserve just as much of a chance to continue in business as a fisherman does. And when we have a bad year, everybody says, well, that's just the breaks have been in business. And, you know, I think that you ought to look at both sides of the coin there. And, you know, because the aviation industry actually is having a bad fishing year right now. We need some help. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for your comments. And I guess my response would be twofold. First thing is I agree with you. And that is why, after the work we did this past fall, we specifically went to the chairman of Labor and Commerce and asked that this subcommittee be formed so we could take a closer look at it, collect data, and try and sell the severity of the problem to the rest of the legislature. In addition, there is precedent. I mean, the state has stepped in, and not just with fishermen and the fishing industry. There has been other times where the state has stepped in and helped a particular industry, whether it's because they couldn't get financing on their vessels, whether they couldn't receive or adequately attained workers' comp insurance. Certainly, there has been areas where precedent has been set, where state has gone in, stepped in, to help an industry that is critical to the, you know, continued success of this state. And I think aviation certainly ranks at the top of the list. In addition, there are other states that have done similar programs. Our research shows that Arkansas, New Hampshire, and even Maine have instituted policies whereby they have, you know, tweaked market conditions or injected the state somehow into a lot, somehow making coverage available on various lines. I mean, in Maine, it was daycare insurance. They were having a hard time receiving daycare insurance, and the state stepped in and allowed them to pool and allowed the state to be involved in some form or another. So there certainly is precedent, and I think that's the approach we're taking. That's going to do it for today. I want to thank everybody. Bob, did you want to add anything? Okay. I certainly want to thank everybody online. We've had some really good testimony. We've really received some great information and some great research the last couple of days. We're going to digest this and have a follow-up hearing next Wednesday at the same time, February 21st at 12:30. You can call my office. The phone number is 800-465-4939. And you can check in with either myself or Kevin and just verify that the teleconference phone number will be the same. Next Wednesday, we are going to invite the Aviation Department at the University of Alaska to discuss their role and potential safety programs. We're going to invite insurance executives from those providing coverage here in the state or those that have pulled out to get their views. We're also going to invite a representative from the Department of Law to talk about tort reform and aircraft liability, as well as we're going to invite the Division of Insurance because they have been just a wealth of information and a tremendous help. So with that, I will close the hearing. Once again, if you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to contact my office. We do have some pretty substantial material we've gained in writing. If you'd like photocopies of this, please give us a call. It might take some time to get out simply because of the volume of the reports. But once again, thank you very much, and we will look forward to having you back next Wednesday at 12:30.